This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with the new chief of staff for Purdue University Northwest, Chancellor Thomas Kean. We'll talk with Richard Rupp about his career as a faculty member on the Hammond campus and how he got interested in taking over the role of working with the chancellor. We'll also have a conversation as well with Ann Massey, who is with the Northwest Indiana Food Council. This coming weekend is the Farm Hop series of local farm tours, four separate tours in four separate corners of Northwest Indiana. We'll find out more about that. And we'll also tell you about an interesting conversation on the Purdue University campus involving a $20 million National Science Foundation grant and fracking. A veteran Purdue University Northwest faculty member who's also been a leader in several campus projects has a new job, that of Chief of Staff to Chancellor Thomas Kean. I talked with Richard Rupp on Friday in the Chancellor's Conference Room on the Hammond campus. Professor Rupp, let me just start things off here by congratulations. And you've heard it maybe from both folks on campus and elsewhere in the general community about taking on the new role of being the Chief of Staff to Purdue Northwest Chancellor Kean. First, for people who are not familiar with Richard Rupp, about yourself, about your career on the campus as well, and what led you with your experiences over the years to get into this opportunity at Chancellor Kean's insistence, I'm sure, to name you as the Chief of Staff.
Well, first off, thanks so much for inviting me into the show today. It's really great to be on and to be asked to talk about Purdue Northwest and the initiatives that we have coming in the coming years and my role that I'll be playing. Well, I have been at Purdue Northwest for about 20 years. I am a political scientist. I don't tell that to a lot of people these days. I tell my mom I wish I had done my PhD in musicology. So my field's political science, and actually within that, my specialization is international relations and primarily armed conflicts, actually. My early work and research and publications focused on NATO and armed conflict in Europe and the Middle East and Russia. So that was my early work on the research side when I arrived at Purdue Northwest. I'm a native of California and San Francisco in particular, and I've been in the area for about 20 years. At a certain point in my career here at Purdue Northwest, I was appointed department head for history and political science, and so I held that position for about 7 years. Many people would say department chair or department head is one of the most challenging jobs on campus, and I still would say that when I talk to my friends who are still in the turf of being department chairs. There's a lot to manage, and it's terribly important work. And so when I stepped down as department head, one, that was a very happy day to step down, and I took a short breather. But what I did is I kept my portfolio of these sort of service projects that I had developed when I was department head. I think in part being a political scientist and in the liberal arts made it more conducive for me to be involved in a lot of projects that I might not have been in, say, if I was the chair of biology or the chair of nursing. So I, my curiosity is pretty wide-ranging, and so over the years I've headed up a number of projects. We've got a lot of support in Northwest Indiana for a program that I've been overseeing for about 7 years, Friday University, started as an idea actually by local community senior activists. They wanted us to do our bit in creating a program where local activists and seniors, not just seniors, could come to Purdue Northwest for a day of educational enrichment. And 7 years later, the program's going gangbusters. And this year we have programs ranging from a lecture that I'm going to be giving. I think we're calling it Objectivity, Rationality, and Discernment in the Age of Trump. Mm-hmm. And so we will be talking about politics in the age of Trump, but it won't all be politics. We've got a class. I'm delighted, actually. I have a biologist on campus, and she was going to I needed a class on the sciences to balance out some of my arts classes, and I called Vanessa Quinn. I said, Vanessa, I need a good science class, so just give me the title. And she came back with just one word, ballroom dancing. So it turns out in her previous life, Vanessa had been a ballroom dancing instructor. Now she's a professor of biology. So we're offering ballroom dancing this year. Anyway, that's too much on Friday University. But I've also been involved in our international programs. I'm, again, a professor of international relations, associate professor of international relations. And I've been very active in our recruitment of foreign students. When I arrived here on campus 20 years ago, it had a very different feel. We did not have dorms in those days. We did not have international students in those days. Today we have thriving dorms, which we're delighted to announce that are at 100% capacity, which we're, that's always a great moment when the university reaches a benchmark such as that. And we have upwards of 700 to 800 international students, which we did not have years ago. So I played a rather active role over the years in our international partnerships and affiliations. And I'm very active also in what we call our freshman year experience. You know, Purdue Northwest, as you know, has a student population over the years that was two-thirds first generation. And there's a special need of first generation college students in the spirit of becoming acclimated to the college experience. And I have been involved with so many of my colleagues, Karen Bishop Morris, Paul Hecht, just an array. I don't want this interview to be all about me, because it's just an array of people who are so singularly involved. And we have devoted a great deal of time into developing programs to really anchor the students in, because at so many universities around the country, the statistics show that a reasonably large percentage of first-generation college students, sometimes their first semester is their last semester. And so we want to do everything we can to make sure that we anchor these students in deep. One of the programs that we have this year, we've had it for quite a few years actually, is called One Book, One University. And it's a program in which the university selects one book to purchase for the entire incoming freshman class, which is over 1,000 students this year. But it's not just a here's a book. It's a very meticulously organized program in which the students are given the book, and it's incorporated into perhaps three or four of their first semester's classes. So this year's book is a glorious book called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, which I'll be happy to come to a show on, and the chancellor will come to a show on. He's all the chancellor of this university is all about trash, and he has had so many conversations about the impactful nature of this study. And so what we have done with this book is that it's woven into the curriculum so that students who are taking communication, Comm 114, will do a speech on it. And students who are taking English 105 will write an essay on it. Or students taking political science with me will do a public policy project on it. And this year, with support of our new provost, Ralph Mueller, we are actually bringing the author into campus, which is a major commitment financially and time, but the author, Edward Humes, will be coming into campus. So, long answer to your question, these are some of the sorts of programs that I've been involved in over the years. I think I was, the chancellor and I worked together on a lot of these projects. And so, it was about 6 months ago, he kind of tapped me on the shoulder. I really wasn't expecting it. And he simply said, what do you think about maybe serving as my chief of staff? And we chatted, and I basically spent the last maybe 4 or 5 months over the summer shadowing him awfully closely. He's been incredibly generous with his time. You couldn't hope to have a better mentor. My learning curve has been just through the roof. It's kind of like taking a foreign language for the first time. I'm learning every day. Now, after we decided, maybe about a month ago, it was a good fit, we decided to make it official. And maybe the only, not so much regret, but the only sadness for me is we've decided I will be pretty much entirely out of the teaching business for the foreseeable future. It would be lovely to teach one class, but the chancellor's days and the university's days are just...
I would imagine, too, that probably maybe if things evolve over time that you're able to sneak a class in someplace along the way, further down the line you'll be able to do so. But for now, you have so many things as the chief of staff on the plate and working with Chancellor Keehan that it's probably better that you step away from being a political science professor.
For a bit, although I did talk to our department head, John Swartz. I'm going to... develop a little event called Pizza and Politics with Professor Rupp. So maybe once a month, I'll buy pizza for the political science students, and we can have a conversation about politics.
That'll be good. They'll miss you, but they'll get over it.
There you go. So there you go.
As the job is evolving now, what do you see as your role looking, obviously, to the future of Purdue University Northwest? We're past the unification. We have both the Hammond and the Westville campuses now together as one. Things are being coordinated better now that we got working through the growing pains, I guess, of bringing two campuses together that are physically separated as much as probably electronically, I would imagine. How do you see the role as the chief of staff working with Chancellor Keehan on that to get the future planning, if it's not already underway, to get it started?
Sure. Well, as you say, the challenging and hard but important work of the merger is largely behind us, and we're very much looking towards the future. And one of the things that makes it exciting to come to the office every day is, frankly, Chancellor Keehan's optimism and his drive about that future. We're not in any way thinking about a static university here. We're using the terminology, we're a 21st century university. And when he talks about it, he says, you know, what are we going to be looking like? Not next year or the year after that, but 10 years, 20 years, 30 years out. And so he's very much focused on the role that Purdue Northwest can play both for the region and the greater region, because he definitely sees the university becoming a central component of almost all societal life, if you will, in Northwest Indiana. So that means economic development, it means sustainable environment, it means educational reform, it means healthcare, it means transportation. And so that Purdue Northwest should play a key role, not just in the important job of educating young people to become good citizens and to become biologists and engineers and political scientists, I suppose, and historians, but what the university can do to play that role in driving Northwest Indiana forward. The main, a central goal of the chancellor in the immediate future is to have Purdue University Northwest designated as a metropolitan university. And we're well on the way to do that. Just a couple of comments about what that means. Currently, according to the Indiana Commission of Higher Education, Purdue Northwest is designated as a regional campus. And when you look at the legal definition of a regional campus, you would find that the focus is very different than our focus today. That a regional campus really was not going to have much of a greater role beyond being hopefully a high-quality teaching institution with some research component. Regional campuses were not conceived to really develop dorms. They were not conceived to see international students. They were not going to be major centers of research. And so when you look at Purdue Northwest now, even though ICHE, Commission of Higher Education, designates us a regional campus, we in point of fact already are a metropolitan campus mm-hmm. like IUPUI and IPFW. Right. So at this point, we're actually... The Chancellor has already had conversations with President Daniels. They've gone very well, and we would envision having that designation soon. But the designation is just the designation. It's kind of what are we going to be doing with that designation. And that will give us, one, the opportunity to create more graduate programs, and we're very keen in the future to identify the graduate programs and the professional programs that will be particularly useful to students and returning students. Graduate students in the region. The chancellor is very keen to reach out to, again, a metropolitan region. And metropolitan in this region means Chicago. And we have our eyes set on the Chicago market. As you probably know, the state of higher education is not particularly solid right now in the state of Illinois, unfortunately, but we are going to do our bit to assist those students in Illinois who would like to have a high-quality education here.
That's an opportunity because we're so close, and there's an opportunity to be able to take advantage of that, not necessarily to Illinois' disadvantage, but because the students either side of the state line, they want an education from someplace, and they'll be happy to take a short drive if they live in Illinois, come across the state line if they're not doing it already,
right,
to come to Indiana and take advantage of what Purdue University Northwest has to offer them.
And it's going to be a shorter drive when the Congressman Visklosky has been pretty successful in company with the expansion of the South Shore. So I think, again, that's why when I talked about the chancellor looking 10 and 20 years down the road, this is how we're starting to conceive this.
Okay. In getting this job together as the chief of staff for Chancellor Keehan, you've talked about the opportunity that you have to use all the experience over the years, academic as well as service to the university, to put it to good use like this. What role do you see the chancellor having to work with you? You've said he's been kind of a mentor to you as you've been getting established in this particular job. How do you see that the chancellor can help you, and you in turn can help him back here in the months ahead as you get more evolved in this position?
Well, one thought is that it strikes me that for this relationship to work well, that is to say, the chancellor of a university and a chief of staff, or any relationship like that, as far as a president and his chief of staff or her chief of staff, it strikes me that the chief of staff should have some skill sets, some organizational skill sets, speaking skill sets, but I think it's actually very important for the two individuals to have a good working rapport and a familiarity. And so that I've always had that with the chancellor, Keehan, but in the last few months when I've been spending most days with him, it has just grown a great deal. So I think we both really enjoy working together. And that's rather important, that the camaraderie is there and some humor is there, and that we're starting to know how each other think. And that can be very helpful. I'm pretty sure he knows how I think more clearly than I know how he thinks, because he's a really, really deep thinker. You spend a lot of time with a man, and his memory is razor sharp, and mine's not. And so I frequently think, oh my stars, I think
so. Those are the advantages that one have that you pair together.
Right.
That you kind of one's
right.
Disadvantages can be one's.
Setting, I think one of the reasons why the chancellor wanted me in this capacity as chief of staff is that I am a faculty member, and that's very important to the chancellor. This university lives and I don't want to say lives and dies, but the faculty is absolutely essential to the university. And I've been a faculty member for a long time, and I'm also, frankly, a very happy faculty member. I think being a university professor is about the best job out there, and so. Part of my job, though, is to understand faculty views, faculty perspectives. I think the chancellor has that knowledge, of course, but I have it pretty intimately because I pretty much know everybody on campus. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully I can bring the insights or the perspectives of a faculty member. And, you know, when you're an administrator and you're a faculty member, we don't always see eye to eye. So hopefully I can play maybe some bridging in that.
Richard Rupp, thank you very much. Congratulations once again. And we hope to have many more conversations
Indeed.
Like this before representing Purdue University Northwest campus here, not only in Hammond, but Westville, too. You get a chance to branch out to both,
Indeed.
And we'll have a chance to talk about them in the future.
Good. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Ivy Tech Community College in Gary is partnering with Indiana University Northwest in the use of the new Arts and Sciences Building, which is being officially put into use as we speak. And as Chancellor of the Academic Affairs at Ivy Tech Community College, Margaret Summer was with us on Regionally Speaking recently and talked about how important the facility will be to all students, Ivy Tech as well as Indiana University Northwest.
We see the building, the Arts and Sciences Building, as a just a potential for collaboration unlike anything we've been able to see or experience before. You know, we've been limited with resources, so we don't have the ability to offer all kinds of curriculum in fine arts and sciences. So exposing our students in the same building is going to really create a synergy that unlike anything we've ever had available to us before. It's a game changer. We're really excited.
Have there been any other facilities, similar facilities, I'm sure, not necessarily designated to Ivy Tech, that have taken place at other Ivy Tech campuses with other universities or other similar types of institutions?
Sure. Well, down in Columbus, Indiana, there's a partnership building as well. And I believe that IU and Purdue are there with Ivy Tech. They are doing things a little bit differently than we plan to do things in Gary, but there have been these partnerships buildings before, and it's been demonstrated that there's success. It's good for students. It's good for the community. It's good for all of us.
They talk about mainly arts here, but I know, of course, there are sciences that will be available as well for students to take classes there in the building. When you talk about even just from the arts standpoint, there's a lot of activities there. Students from Ivy Tech Community College are probably either certainly interested in it as a personal basis, but for an educational basis. How do you think the link is going to be from the courses and the opportunities out maybe outside of class even at IU Northwest will have for the Ivy Tech students?
Well, obviously, the opportunities are going to be infinite. So, you know, just having students exposed to the different kinds of laboratories and facilities. I don't know if you've been over to the building yet. It's hard not to notice the energy and just the feel of it being a very sophisticated space for arts and sciences. So, you know, I see that there's just going to be a lot of integrating between Ivy Tech students and IU students. We're going to be working towards developing agreements where students flow, you know, seamlessly from their Ivy Tech education to the IU bachelor's degree. And that's going to provide just all kinds of opportunities for students as they participate and as they have, this really fulfilling educational experience in the building.
It's very important that people know that this facility is this partnership between IU Northwest and Ivy Tech Community College and the opportunities for students to learn in state-of-the-art facilities has got to be very, very exciting for students, especially if they're young people who are already experienced a lot of the technology at home or in other places.
Right. Well, you know, and again, going to not really, you know, our limited resources and not being able to update things is to the degree we would have liked in the past, just, you know, I'm going to brag about the science labs, okay? So, you know, what we keep hearing is that we probably right now, Ivy Tech has the most state-of-the-art science labs in the region. And that is so exciting for our students, just to see the energy of the students and the faculty. Oh, they're so excited about teaching there. It's just an amazing step for us at Ivy Tech to really have this facility at our, you know, at our fingertips and for the students to have that opportunity to really, you know, really understand. And we do know that some of our high school students that come to Ivy Tech, they have great high schools in Northwest Indiana, and they've had some exposure to some really state-of-the-art technology. And so, you know, we need to keep pace with that. We need to be right there where the technology is and where it's going. And we're doing that here in the Arts and Sciences building.
We're talking with Margaret Semmer, who is the Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs for Ivy Tech Community College in Gary. And Ivy Tech Community College, of course, is one of the beneficiaries of the new IU Northwest Arts and Sciences building. We've talked about the exciting opportunities that students are going to have in this new building with state-of-the-art labs, the science labs, and the like. I'm thinking, too, this has to be a big benefit not only for students of Ivy Tech Community College who would want to follow through and become students at IU Northwest to benefit their education and their career opportunities, but how about adult students? They certainly are coming into Ivy Tech to pick up some new skills, to learn the new workplaces of the future in Northwest Indiana. This has got to help them out, too.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because at Ivy Tech, a large percentage of our students are returning adult students. Everybody will think, not everybody, but, you know, we have a sort of an image that we're for high school students that aren't going away to the four-year universities. But at the same time, we have this huge population of adult learners that we're hoping to touch and capture and bring them into the fold and have them experience all of these new technologies and you know, obviously retrain, improve their skills, you know, do something different. I mean, that's a part of life now. We don't stay in one career for a lifetime anymore. We change. We need to grow. We need new skills. And we're really excited about that opportunity for our adult students. It's a game changer, and we're really excited.
That's Margaret Semmer, who is the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at Ivy Tech's Gary Campus, talking about the opportunities that Ivy Tech Community College has as part of the new Arts and Sciences building on the IU Northwest campus. Coming up on Saturday, September 23rd, the Northwest Indiana Food Council and some sponsors are getting together to create a very interesting event for anybody who lives in Northwest Indiana. In fact, there will be four opportunities in separate corners of the region to be able to check out farms and actually find out about the farmers who grow your food locally. And we turn now to Ann Massey with the Food Council, who's helped organize this big event, which is called Farm Hop. Ann, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Farm Hop, the thinking behind it, and be able to tell people how important it is to do an actual chance to visit where your food's grown. And it doesn't matter whether it's produce or whether it's eggs or the like. You get to learn something about it if you like.
Part of the reasoning behind it was because we have so many thriving farmers markets, and the community supports them pretty strongly. But a lot of our community members haven't had a chance to actually go to the farms that are represented at our farmers markets. So we wanted to give an opportunity for people to get on the farm, see where their produce comes from at the farmers markets, meet the farmers, and really truly check out farms that aren't typically open to the public. We have quite a few agritourist spots in Northwest Indiana, like the Orchards and Fair Oaks Farm, that you can check out all the time. But this opportunity is for family-owned places that you don't normally get to see.
Now, we emphasized here at the start of our conversation that there will be four locations in different corners of the region that you can visit if there is one area in particular that you are closest to or you'd like to stick close by and check out what farms are available. That's the advantage of Farm Hop. And you can find out more, by the way, if you go online to the Northwest Indiana Food Council's website to see more information about Farm Hop coming up. But let's take the regions by section here now. And tell us, since you've made it as convenient as possible for anybody that wants to check out a farm operation in their particular neighborhood, what's interesting is this runs the range of urban farms to truly farms. Tell us, if you will, first about the whole group of urban farms that is highlighted for folks who live the closest to Gary.
Sure. This one's really exciting and unique. They're all urban farms or community gardens. I think we have six or seven farms on this tour, so it's pretty jam-packed. They're all fairly close together compared to our other tours, which are more spread out, being rural. We have the Blind Social Center Living and Learning Garden. It's a really, really neat place for people with visual impairment or other physical mobility issues. Mm-hmm. The garden is set up to be very fragrant and enticing to the nose. And there will be, eventually they have a whole plan where they're going to have talking modules at each raised bed for the visually impaired to be able to go up either in their wheelchair or physically walk up to the beds and be able to hear what is growing inside the beds and touch them. Faith Farms is a really unique farm in the Emerson neighborhood. And they have solar panels on their church that actually provide power to the whole church, and four high tunnels that grow year-round. Mm-hmm. They actually are able to supply a restaurant and church members and some other markets. Peace Garden and Farms, they're in the west side of Gary. They have a really unique plan that eventually is going to turn into a workforce plan where they'll be employing people from the community to operate their farm. Stewart House Urban Garden and Farms, they grow enough. I think they have 26 raised beds that are actually fully supporting produce right now.
Wow.
And they're just off of Broadway on Massachusetts, and it's a really neat farm to see, and they've been around for at least 5 years. I can move on to tour number two.
Yeah,
that kind of wraps up.
And that's in Valparaiso, too, by the way. And by the way, we should mention, too, when you find out more on going to the Northwest Indiana Food Council website, you can find out about how to sign up for the event, which is happening coming up here on September 23rd. It's a daytime series of tours from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And in each mm-hmm. area of the county, the counties, rather, that are involved in the tours will have opportunities for lunch as well. So you can spend the day out on the farm, so to speak. Tell us now about the tour that is going to be based around Valparaiso.
Sure. This one's pretty cool and diverse for rural farms. One of the first farms is Three Guys and Some Chicks in Valparaiso, and the family The children actually run the egg laying operation. They have almost 600 egg laying hens. They're all free range. So it's quite a riot and a bit of a circus to be there. The chickens are literally everywhere. The farm after that is Bucher Farms down in La Crosse. They're a conventional corn and soy farm with a really interesting background. The farmer actually wasn't a farmer until recently, but he worked on Wall Street and decided to retire before the age of 40 and get into farming.
Wow, this sounds like the Green Acres TV show, kind of.
Yes, it's really, a lot of our farmers, which we didn't plan this, most of our farms actually have only started in the last 5 years. So all the farmers are actually pretty young. The last farm on the Valpo tour is Howe Farms. They're a hop farm in Crown Point, Winfield area. They supply hops to 4 local breweries in northwest Indiana, in addition to growing local produce and raising heritage breed hogs, cattle, and chickens.
Okay. Now, we're talking with Ann Massey from the Northwest Indiana Food Council about Farm Hop, which is coming up on Saturday, September 23rd. The LaPorte tour is going to include a place that maybe some people have already visited, but it's worth checking out again, Chelberg Farms. Tell us about Chelberg Farms and the other places that are on the LaPorte section of the tour.
Sure. Chelberg Farm is a historic farm. They've tried to recreate a garden that would have existed at the turn of the century in 1900. The interesting thing about this farm, in addition to being historic, is that they've also teamed up with the Dunes Learning Center. Mm-hmm. So children come to have hands-on learning in the garden, and curriculum is designed around their activities out there. The Discovery Charter School has a pollinator garden, which is set up to support butterflies, bees, and other pollinators like that. The PAC Center has a church and community kitchen in downtown LaPorte, and they operate the Jackson Street Community Garden, which is a really neat model. They offer free U-Pick for anybody in the neighborhood who might need food. And then Rainfield Farm, they are a 13-acre organic produce farm in New Carlisle, Indiana. They grow enough to gross nearly 100,000 a year, which is a really exciting thing to happen. For a small farm in our region to know that it is a sustainable operation, that young people can get into it without having a farming background. The farmer there is actually a marketer in Chicago and left the rat race to start his own farm.
That's great. Now, if you will, Ann, take us back to Crown Point. That's the last of the 4 tours that we'll mention here that you can check out.
Sure. The Crown Point tour is a little more easily paced than some of our other farms. There are 2 farms on this tour that are both known for organic vegetable production. This leaves from the Crown Point Farmers Market and heads down south to DeMott, to Perkins Good Earth Farm. The farmer is a soil scientist, so he has a really unique approach to each of his plots, and is pretty methodical about how he grows everything, and they intensively farm a 1/4 acre on their 12-acre farm. Then on to Couts is Acorn Acres, and they are a biodynamic farm growing organic produce and vegetables both outside and in a greenhouse that is heated by a wood-fired stove, which is really cool and unique. And they also have heritage breed animals from cattle to sheep, chickens, and hogs.
Now, we should mention again that the Farm Hop tours for 2017 all set up now. You can go on to the Northwest Indiana Food Council website and find out more and to be able to get tickets for the event as well, too. One other thing, too, we should mention, too, Ann Massey, before we go, is to talk about Market Wagon. That's a very important and very interesting online farmer's market that's available here, too, and folks that get involved with the tour can take advantage of that, too, I understand.
Market Wagon is a new online farmer's market where you can purchase produce and other goods from local producers online, and it is delivered right to your home or to a local drop spot, which is really, really cool. They have offered a $20 voucher to anyone who goes on the Farm Hop tours, And in addition to that, Nature's Cupboard in Chesterton and Valpo has also offered a $10 coupon for their produce co-op. And Edible Michiana will be providing a copy of their latest issue for each guest as well.
That's right. Now, if anybody would like to find out more about Farm Hop coming up and get the tickets available, what's the website for the Northwest Indiana Food Council?
Sure. It's www.nwifoodcouncil.org.
Very simple. Ann Massey is with the Food Council telling us about the upcoming event. Food Hop 2017 is going to be on Saturday, September 23rd. Four separate, very distinct tours in four corners of Northwest Indiana. You can check out on the website more about the one that happens to be in your particular area. And Ann Massey, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Indiana will receive more than $3.5 million in federal funds to tackle the opioid epidemic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the money will primarily be used to increase behavioral health services.
The Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA, will distribute more than $200 million in grants to qualifying health centers around the country that serve patients regardless of ability to pay. Indianapolis's Raphael Health Center CEO, Dee Routabush, says the funding comes just in time.
All of the health centers are trying to treat this problem, and it's taking all of our resources to do it.
Routabush says her center will use the money, more than $175,000, to train all staff on substance use disorders, increase counseling, and hire psychiatrists. HRSA spokesperson Martin Kramer says another $3 million will go to rural health providers in 8 states, including Indiana. He says those areas typically have limited access to care.
Hopefully help these rural communities increase their telehealth ability to provide substance abuse disorder services and mental health services.
More than 1,200 people in Indiana died from a drug overdose in 2015. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
One, two, three, four. Each Friday night game night takes you across Northwest Indiana, from the Northwest Crossroads to the Duneland, from the Greater South Shore to the Great Lakes. We're covering region football. Hosts Tommy Williams and Wayne Svetnoff, with their team of correspondents, provides you the scores and updates as they happen. Tune in each Friday night at 6 p.m. for Game Night here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Do you know what is really happening in Northwest Indiana? If you want to go beyond the brief article in the newspaper or the short piece on the daily news, then join us for Lakeshore Focus each Friday evening at 7:30 as we interview fascinating people with real stories about interesting issues. We will make you think, maybe scratch your head, or even laugh. That's Lakeshore Focus, Friday evenings at 7:30 on Lakeshore Public Television.
Sometimes an announcement is as notable for what's not in it as for what it is. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Stan Jastrzebski reports that was the case last week at Purdue University, as the university announced a $20 million National Science Foundation grant to study fossil fuels and pollution from them.
The money will help a Purdue-led national research center study what its leaders are calling bridge fuels. In other words, fuel made from gas that's trapped in underground rock. It's extracted through hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. The researchers say it'll be needed to satisfy the country's demand for oil until renewable resources like wind and solar become the dominant energy sources in the future. But there was no mention of the F word, fracking, during a public celebration of the grant or in any of the promotional materials concerning it. It's a controversial technology that some environmentalists say can poison groundwater or cause earthquakes due to increased underground pressure. But Purdue officials insist it was not a conscious choice to avoid that charged terminology. Here's Vice President for Research and Partnerships Suresh Giramella, who's also an engineer.
If you wrote a book on this, we would talk about a lot of this stuff, right? This is a short press release that talks about the research, and we're focused on our contribution to this thing, which is a good contribution.
Purdue will lead a 5-university team on the project. That group will be headed by chemical engineering professor Fabio Ribeiro, who says fracking isn't a concern with this research.
We didn't mention the word hydraulic fracturing, or what they call fracking, because we are what's called downstream. Those are the people that's called upstream, that does the production of the oil. We don't do production. We do, once the oil and the gas is out of the ground, that's when we come.
But other environmental scientists disagree.
To the extent that they want to make the argument about, you know, this just being a bridge fuel that will help lower carbon emissions, or greenhouse gas emissions, I should say, then upstream is part of the equation that I think you can't ignore.
That's Colin Jeralnik, chair of New York University's Environmental Studies Department. He's researched how communities are affected by fracking and says he doesn't even believe that the process poses the large-scale threats to groundwater that some scientists claim it does. But he says he understands why Purdue's press release might have avoided using that term.
It mentions twice that there are industry partners. It doesn't say who those industry partners are or what their role is. You know, I would imagine that their industry partners, if they're from the gas industry, would not like them using the word fracking.
Fabio Ribeiro says he does see an end point to Purdue's research in about half a century.
We're not going to be able to not use fossil fuels for, we think, about 50 years. Why not use the resources that are in this country so that we could be energy efficient? We don't energy efficient, but also we don't need to use energy from import from other sources.
But Hoosier Environmental Council Executive Director Jesse Carbonda says researchers could move much faster than that.
Premier universities like Purdue ought to be at the forefront of focusing on zero carbon technologies. We believe that our society can leapfrog from our current fossil fuel dominated economy to a renewables economy far faster than might be perceived by some.
And NYU's Colin Jeralnik says the longer it takes to get away from fossil fuels, of which shale gas is one, the harder that transition will be.
We create an entire infrastructure around it, right? Like liquefying natural gas, creating all these process centers. Then we're putting a lot of fixed capital in another hydrocarbon that is going to make us not want to transition to renewable energy. So I'm very skeptical of this argument about bridge fuel in the long run.
Terms such as fossil fuels and fracking are also avoided in the name of Purdue's new engineering research center, which is called CSTAR, the Center for Innovative and Strategic Transformation of Alkane Resources. Oh, and one last thing that was conspicuously absent from the gala celebrating the National Science Foundation grant, current NSF Director France Cordova, Purdue's immediate past president. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stan Jastrzebski in West Lafayette.
Healthy food access at food banks and pantries is a relatively new trend, but the efforts to stock shelves with fresh produce can be difficult. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan is back to tell us about one new program that offers a solution that loops in the local farmers.
Food Finders in Lafayette is good at doing just that, finding food. And CEO Katie Bunder feels she's ahead of the game when it comes to finding fresh, nutritious options for her clients.
I always remind myself that low-income people want the same thing high-income people want, good, healthy food.
She says it's one of the top requests, but in the past, produce hasn't always been the best.
But we've got, right now, we've got avocados, limes, apples, oranges.
There's a better understanding of the relationship between the food that lower-income people eat and higher rates of obesity and other poor health outcomes.
And we just recently in our pantry here decided not to distribute to our clients donuts, cakes, cupcakes, all of that stuff. But, you know, we got far fewer complaints than we thought we would. And so now we use that shelf space for something that's better.
In recent years, Food Finders increased produce distribution by 103%. And a new regional produce center run out of Gleaners in Indianapolis helps stock shelves. But there's always room for new ideas. Tamara Benjamin works in diversified farming and food systems at Purdue. She was at church earlier this year and thought about what a farmer recently told her.
He was telling me about how they were going to be tilling under all these heads of romaine lettuce. And so during the sermon, I spaced off and thought, you know what? Why can't we do something for Food Finders and for food waste?
The name Waste Not, Want Not came to her almost immediately. But there was still plenty of details to work out. First, she says, is finding a price that works for the food bank and the farmers.
Can we find a price point that maybe they're not making a lot of money, they're not making what they would make maybe at farmer's market, but they're also not losing money? And can we find that, and especially can we get money to Food Finders so they can offer that better price point?
Food Finders budgets a few $1,000s a week for produce, but it needs a network it can draw on. Plus, Benjamin notes, a farmer's clock is always ticking.
You know, they're on a schedule. It's either come out in the next 2 hours or forget it. And so that's part of the problem is we don't have this large urban population to get gleaners out there at a moment's notice. And most farmers are not willing to wait.
Nate Parks owns Silverthorn Farms with his wife. They produce up to 500,000 pounds of fruit and vegetables in a season. He's known for his heirloom tomatoes that are grown in greenhouses.
Look at these tomato plants. You know, like to grow this from a seed, everything on this farm is started from a seed.
Most of his crops go to local restaurants and community ag programs.
Freshness, health, taste is all related to vitamins and minerals. That's what makes flavor. That's what makes taste.
When Parks had a field of romaine mature early, he didn't have a lot of choices.
Plowing it under saves us money. Yes, I'd love to go out there and pick that, wash that, pack that, deliver it to food finders because there's a lot of people who need that food. My margins are so incredibly small, I can't afford to pay my people to go do that and give it away.
He says food waste happens when you're a Hoosier farmer who deals with an unpredictable climate.
You're hedging your bets and putting more crop out so that you're safe when you have bad weather incidents. Now you have an abundance.
Food Finders has been able to purchase lettuce from Parks through its Waste Not, Want Not program. Katie Bunder says when it connects clients with fresh local produce and educates them about how delicious it can be, it's a win.
If we can give people a strawberry, you know, then maybe they won't feel the need to eat as many cookies or candy.
The program plans to use Purdue's Extension Network to reach more Indiana farmers. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And on this Monday, it's another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Katie Holderby, who is the Executive Vice President at the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority for a very long time.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing, Katie?
Great. I'm wonderful.
So your next exhibit in your big exhibition hall is with the Area Artists Group from Michigan City, right?
Yes, they're at the Lubesnik Center, and it runs until September the 24th at the Indiana Welcome Center in the W.F. Wellman Exhibit Hall.
Ooh. And lots of artists are involved in it, I would imagine.
Lots of artists. I think there's about 40-plus artists, and they probably have an average of 5 pieces each.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a big show,
yeah,
then.
Yeah, it's a big show for us.
How fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot to see. Is there a special reception for it?
There was a reception that has passed, and it was very well attended. It was a good way to kick off the exhibit, and we're looking forward to many more family and friends and visitors come in to see the exhibit.
How many people... I suppose the summertime is the busiest for you.
It is.
And so how many, in the summertime, how many people come to the building on average every day?
We average about 3,000 to 4,000 a month, maybe little more. It's probably more in the summertime, about 5,000.
Wow.
The nice thing about where we're located to is that being outside of Chicagoland, there are many travelers that come through past Labor Day. Even when our kids go back to school in Northwest Indiana, there's certainly a lot of people traveling from other states that go back to school after Labor Day and just throughout the fall. Fall is still a busy time for travel.
Yeah, I would think so. People like it's cooler weather, a little bit cooler, and it's pleasant to.
Lots of campers. We still see a lot of RVers and campers and a lot of travelers from Europe. We see a lot of travelers from Europe in the fall. We do.
Huh, that's interesting. So back to the exhibit. What's in it? What kind of artwork is in it? Is this something you've ever done before?
We have not worked with this group. Mm-hmm. We like to have exhibits like this because there's a lot of different mediums. When we have single artists like photography shows or paintings, it's all very consistent. But this is many different mediums, including sculptures. And there's one artist that his name is Larry Jensen. He has these three-dimensional pieces. Some of them are bowls. Some of them are just sculptures. But they're made out of coffee grounds, blue cornmeal. And he makes a resin, and it just turns into a solid surface. And just the coloring that comes through and the dimension, it's really unique. You would never know. Do you know Larry?
I do know him, and I know his work. And we've done a show for him at our Branch and Crown Point. I think that was a couple of years ago, maybe. But yeah, I've been aware of him for all the time I've worked at the Art Center in Munster, which is a while.
Yeah, he's real interesting. I'd never met him before. Real interesting art, interesting descriptions, because you wouldn't guess that that's what it was. Yeah. It was really neat. It was neat to look at.
Oh, so that's your favorite piece of
his
work.
That's my favorite,
your
yes.
personal favorite. Does Spiro have a favorite?
I'm not sure what his favorite is. He tends to like scenic and photography type
I know
art.
He was crazy about, in your recycled art exhibit, that guy who did those big metal things, and
he does like that. And we do have some metal pieces in this exhibit too, so those might be his favorites. This is the first year in almost, I want to say, in 20 years that we have not had Trash to Treasure. So
yeah,
that was our longest running exhibit.
Uh-huh.
We're hoping to bring it back. It kind of didn't work out this year, even though we're happy with the exhibit that we have now, and there is some recycled materials in there. But this is the first time in 20 years we have not had that exhibit.
That's interesting.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, because that's really fun. That people like to look at that stuff and the creativity that's involved in recycling and reusing and repurposing, as they say nowadays.
Seems to be real trendy.
Yeah. Well, I know we're working on an exhibit together that we're going to do next summer.
Next summer.
Kathy Lowe's Rothburn.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Well, I'm glad that you're giving artists an opportunity to show in such a public venue, really, that you're visited by so many people that we wouldn't be visited by at an art center necessarily, because they think art, oh, scary.
And when people come into the building to use the restroom or go in the gift shop, they do. They go into the exhibit hall and, you know, sometimes they even purchase a piece. We've had travelers come through and purchase, which you can do at this exhibit too.
Oh, good. That's great. And your gift shop, I should say, is really, you have a whole new gift shop. It's really nice.
We do. We have a lot of local product. In addition to, you know, a Christmas Story items and things that travelers like to buy. But it's a good mix of products.
And you have a
products.
Coffee shop.
And we do sell coffee. We're hoping to expand that in the next year and add other product. But right now it's just coffee and soft drinks.
Cool. Well, good. Thanks, Katie, for being here to talk about your exhibit. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
John King with Eye on the Arts, talking to Katie Holderby of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority about regional impressions and expressions, the exhibit that's on right now through September 24th. You can catch this and other Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And join us next Monday for another Eye on the Arts right here on Regionally Speaking.